All right. Welcome back to the podcast, everybody. Today, we have a great group of people who have been involved in the weird, wild, wonderful, and amazing world of biochar. So that may be a topic that's familiar to some of you. Maybe some of you are not familiar, never heard of it, but we're going to try to cover all the bases and give you the background you need and talk about some of the exciting developments in this sector of people who like to make charcoal and put it in the ground and do other weird things like that. So I'd like to turn it over now to the guests. Maybe we'll start with Miles to introduce yourself, and we'll just go around and everybody kind of state your name and your background and your function and how you have intersected with the biochar world, and then we'll get into some topics.
Great, thanks for having me, Josh. My name is Miles Gray. I'm the program director of the U.S. Biochar Initiative. My kind of biochar life goes back to about 2010 when I got a master's in biochar, and then worked in the engineering world for about 8 years doing stormwater work, but used a lot of biochar in those projects. And then about 2 years ago, started working for a large biochar startup, and now I'm at the U.S. Biochar Initiative.
Cool. Kelpie?
Yeah, I'm Kelpie Wilson. I have a consulting company called Wilson Biochar Associates and another company that manufactures a biochar kiln, the Ring of Fire kiln. Golly, how did I get involved? I'm an engineer of a mechanical engineering degree, and I worked for many years in forest conservation, which is kind of not related, but actually biochar brings that together for me. And let's see, around about 2005, when peak oil was kind of a topic in the news, I was writing articles about that and climate change and other environmental issues for online news sources. And that's when I heard about biochar and ended up going to the very first biochar conference that took place in Australia, and then worked for the International Biochar Initiative for 4 years after that. And then I've been a consultant since then.
Right on.
Yeah, and I would add that that Kelpie manages our Biochar in the Woods outreach and education project, which is pretty exciting. I'm Tom Miles. I'm executive director of the U.S. Biochar Initiative. My day job that supports my biochar habit is that I'm a biomass energy engineering consultant. We design, develop systems for materials handling and for energy, and that's what really brought me into biochar. Done a lot of work in the past with manures and litters, crop residues, and all these sources of nutrients that can cause issues when they're concentrated. And in about 2004, discovered that looking at activated carbon, discovered that biochar could be used as a slow release agent for the nutrients in manures and so on. And we always have the black stuff as a co-product of any of the gasification, pyrolysis, or combustion processes that we use for generating energy. And so I became interested in biochar, created a biochar discussion list that still goes on today called biocharatgroups.io. We put together the list in 2006 to support the creation of what became the International Biochar Initiative. I was on the board of the International Biochar Initiative from about 2014 to the present. And we created the U.S. Biochar Initiative, and we had our first conference in 2009 in Colorado. In 2010, we created the organization. It was run as a kind of a project of a nonprofit until 2016. 2016, we put on a biochar conference in Corvallis, Oregon, at Oregon State University. And at that point, our executive director had resigned, and so we created the organization as a 501c3 nonprofit. And we've been working on promoting the production and use of biochar ever since. So we have a board of about 13 people. We have a number of people who contribute both voluntarily and as contractors and so on to the organization. And we've watched biochar production grow from small scale to some larger scale, and there are projects underway that are even larger at this time.
Cool. That's a great intro. Thanks, you guys. So for people listening that maybe are not familiar with biochar, I just wanted to cover some terms and definitions. So so I'll kind of give that from my perspective, and then you guys chime in and critique or add to or whatever as you see fit. But the idea of creating biochar is that you know, if you take some kind of biomass, wood or straw or whatever, and you heat it in the presence of oxygen, you cause a fire, you burn it, and you convert it to ash. Well, if you heat it in a restricted oxygen environment, it makes a charcoal-like material, which you might find, the next morning after a campfire and some material that didn't burn all the way and so on. It's also the process that's used to make charcoal, which is usually used as a cooking fuel. And the idea is that when you convert raw biomass to charcoal, you convert the carbon to a form that's recalcitrant and takes a long time to break down in the environment. And so it can be seen as a form of carbon storage, for example, in the soil. People discovered that it had some beneficial properties in agricultural soils, helping to retain nutrients and water and that sort of thing. And then also over the years, we've discovered a variety of kind of quirky engineering properties of these materials that have led people to explore different types of environmental remediation applications. So that with that little bit of an intro, do y'all have anything to add to that or what you see as important areas to emphasize about why people should care about biochar?
I would just say that, sorry, Tom. Add that biochar is charcoal. And that's what it is, but charcoal can have a lot of different properties depending on what it's made from, what temperature it's made at, and some of the other processing conditions. So the official definition of biochar that we came up with at the IBI is biochar is charcoal with a purpose. And that purpose is it's either going to be used in soil or other biological systems, so it's compatible with biology, or it's used for carbon sequestration. So it's kind of a weird two-part definition, but just so people understand, biochar is just charcoal, but not all charcoal is good to add to soil. And not all charcoal is going to be great for carbon sequestration.
Yeah, just to build on that a little bit, it's charcoal, but you cook it long enough, so you're cooking out the tars and oils, and so now you have charcoal that has a honeycomb-like structure. It has pores that can absorb moisture, nutrients, and so on. And in various places, we have the International Biochar Initiative started out with a standard, definitions of standards. To make sure that biochar was safe, stable, and sustainable. And then, and at the same time, and from that, various organizations, the European Biochar Industry Council and the Australian New Zealand Biochar Industry Group have created sets of standards for biochars for different applications. And the applications span, although a lot of the early emphasis was on the use of biochar for soil improvement, which, for example, we see in the Amazon where biochar in the soil brought the pH of the soil up to a point where you weren't losing nutrients and this sort of thing. It was beneficial, building up over thousands of years and became what was known as terra preta. And now in manufacturing biochar on a shorter cycle than the thousands of years that it took to build up the terra preta, the various biochar and biochar-based products have been developed. So it's really reached a level of you want to call it industrialization or whatever. At this time, we don't have any U.S. biochar standards. We pretty much follow the International Biochar Initiative standards as kind of a reference point in terms of biochar quality. But biochar qualities can definitely differ for different applications.
Miles, do you have anything to add?
I think what we're doing is hacking the carbon cycle to remove carbon from the atmosphere. Normally waste biomass would go back to the atmosphere as CO2 within maybe 20 years at most. And I view it as really hacking the carbon cycle to take that waste material and turn it into a form that lasts for about 1,000 years. So it's buying us time to solve, to decarbonize.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That's because biochar is not just a noun, it's also a verb, right? So it's a product, but it's also a process. I think it's what Miles is talking about.
Okay, so maybe to conceptualize, we have these, let's just say for simplicity, we have these three domains of like drivers for biochar programs. You've got the soil amendment, benefits to soil, benefits to crop side. You've got the carbon sequestration side. And then you have the sort of variety of remediation, environmental applications, and that sort of thing. So if that's the kind of framework for thinking of three major areas of interest in biochar, what do you think are the main drivers? What have been the drivers historically in the interest in this sector? Have those drivers changed? Have you seen, you know, one or other elements of it come to the fore as being maybe more important or just receiving more attention or more potential in terms of building a business or getting funding? When you think of those drivers, what do you like to emphasize, or what do you think are the most promising areas?
I think right now, Josh, what's driving the industry right now is carbon dioxide removal credits. So there's a big push globally to in sort of pursuit of net zero targets by 2050. In pursuit of those targets, I think there's a recognition, obviously, that there are going to be certain sectors of the economy that are extremely hard to decarbonize. Jet fuel is a great example. Concrete production, agriculture, nitrous oxide emissions from agriculture. There are going to be parts of our economy that cannot be decarbonized entirely. And so carbon removal, removing carbon from the atmosphere, is going to be a key component of maintaining some sort of net zero target and also in drawing down those legacy emissions. So the world really is focusing on, a lot of the carbon world is focused right now on carbon dioxide removal, things like direct air capture, enhanced weathering, and biochar. And I think all of us feel like biochar is the most sensible approach to doing carbon dioxide removal. And so I think that's what's really driving the industry right now, is the availability of high value carbon removal credits using biochar.
Okay, I want to come back to that and drill down into that a little bit more. But Tom and Kelpie, I want to ask you, do you concur with that? What about, for example, I'm not an expert in this area of biochar, but my understanding is that in terms of boosting crop yields and as a soil amendment, that biochar additions can make a beneficial difference. Typically, if you're starting with a very poor soil and it needs to improve its water holding capacity or its nutrient holding capacity or something like that, but that in soils that are already okay, maybe you don't see that much of an effect. Now, do you concur with that, or am I off in my thinking there? And what about this, the crop yield, food production, soil quality driver of biochar? Has that lost any focus recently, or is it just sort of in the shadow of carbon credits now, or what?
No, I think the role of carbon credits is because about 3 years ago, or actually about 5 years ago, we saw the evolution of voluntary markets for carbon credits. And what the impact of that has been, that it has enabled financing for, I'll call it industrial scale systems. So when you're talking about millions of dollars to develop systems and so on, or you're talking about recovering large volumes of carbon on the industrial scale as a co-product or byproduct, and that's happening primarily in the US and in Europe. And to a certain degree, a very small degree in Australia. I think if you look at other parts of the world, you see more of an artisanal level soil amendment focus of taking those very, very poor soils, like in the Amazons, the low pH, 2.5, adding charcoal, bringing the pH up to 5.5, a level where you can actually bring those soils into production. We see this in southern sub-Saharan Africa, where the soils have almost no carbon in it. And it's been joked that you could use shoe leather and add carbon that way to soil. But we actually have thousands of smallholders who are using biochar in combination with a nutrient source, typically manure. And they'll go pick up dried manure and add it to the biochar and put it in the planting hole and improve the productivity of that. They reduce the water requirement. They improve the yield. They improve the nutrition. They stop buying synthetic fertilizers and herbicides and pesticides because they make healthy plants. In China, the largest experiment is that production is about 200,000 tons of an industrially manufactured biochar-based fertilizer, in which you use biochar minerals and fertilizer components and produce a bag product, which is identical. It's a 15-10-10 NPK fertilizer, identical to the fertilizer that farmers ordinarily use. They get a government subsidy or credit for using a biochar-based product to sequester carbon. And they've been in production at that level for a few years. They're reassessing to see what the production levels and what the farmer adoption has actually been. But basically what they've done is provide a fertilizer product biochar-based fertilizer product that is identical to the fertilizer product that they ordinarily use at an affordable price. One of the challenges we have here in the United States is that biochar is expensive to the farmer. So who's going to pay that high cost, upfront cost of applying biochar to the soil, even on an experimental basis, that maybe won't show any kind of benefit for 2 or 3 or 4 years? So there's been an evolution of the kinds of strategic applications of biochar in combination with nutrients and other components, delivered in particular ways using special tillage techniques and that sort of thing. But we're really at a point, I think the winner in that process in the United States has been biochar amended compost. People have discovered that biochar added to compost in the 20% by volume, 10% by weight kind of a relationship improves water holding capacity, improves productivity, and especially when used at establishment in crops, has shown tremendous yields in things like blueberries and mostly high value crops, potatoes, vineyards, and so on. So there's a small growing adoption at, I'll call it an agro-industrial scale, but we're still pretty small. and a lot of the inhibition has been due to cost. We have a lot of science now. We've got 30,000 peer-reviewed papers and studies and meta-studies and so on of how biochar works and what to do with it. But the implementation, getting the products bought, used at competitive prices, taking the pig to market, has been something of a challenge.
Right. Kelby, what do you have to add to that from your experience?
Well, the first question you get from farmers is, well, how do I use this stuff? And we don't always have a really good answer. And that's one of the reasons for that is because you don't really just want to throw biochar into soil. It doesn't, I mean, think about it. It doesn't react in the terms of a degradation reaction. Microbes can't really eat it, most of it, but it has a stimulating effect. It's small, you might even call it a biostimulant. And so it has all these really neat effects in soil, and they take a little time to develop. And, you know, one of the things it can do, for instance, is it can kind of scavenge nitrogen in the soil and hold on to it, which is good in one sense because it is going to be plant available eventually. But if you add biochar at the wrong time and there's not enough nitrogen, it can kind of starve that year's crop. And so it has to go through a conditioning process. And what is starting to happen, as Tom mentioned, is people are seeing the value of its use in compost. But really, it's not just because it changes the biochar, it also changes the composting process for the better. And so that's not a huge driver yet, but you know, it now the carbon sequestration benefits of biochar are being recognized and valued and paid for. We need the other ecosystem services benefits also valued and paid for, especially in terms of managing other organic waste streams. Like there's all these mandates now to do food waste composting from cities. That is very difficult to do. And what biochar can add to that process is it immediately stops the putrefaction reactions. And so you can get a much better compost. You can process more compost on the same site with fewer greenhouse gas emissions. And then what you end up is something like the Chinese product, the slow release fertilizer with biochar that Tom was talking about, but it's an organic composting product. But you know, it's just people are not really understanding that yet, especially people who are in charge of making all these things, you know, all these composting processes happen, and waste management and manure management is a huge one, just huge. So that's what should be driving it in my mind, is managing other organic waste streams.
That's awesome. I'm super glad you mentioned that. I have a project with a food waste composting and upcycling facility in Austin, Texas, and biochar is a component of what we're doing there. And the head of that company, we actually had him on the podcast a couple of months back. So that's definitely an interesting big challenge, like handling all food waste from big cities like Austin and composting it, or finding other ways to sort it and upcycle the components of the waste stream and make higher value products and stuff. So that's a super interesting topic. I want to kind of drill down a little bit into a topic that I know will be interesting to a lot of the audience here, as what was mentioned a few times, of carbon credits and the idea of looking at CO2 drawdown from the atmosphere and carbon sequestration and carbon credit mechanisms for driving this kind of thing. I definitely want to get your all's opinion on this. I know there's like a lot of skepticism and a lot of criticism of carbon credits and whether these are really meaningful. You know, I've definitely seen some reports that say that 80 to 90% of carbon credit schemes are essentially invalid. You know, they don't really translate to actual benefits there. So I'd like to get your take on that kind of thing. And then something else that a lot of what we think about in the doomer optimism sphere, we think about the scale of a lot of these different challenges. And so I was just thinking back, I should have pulled up this before the talk, but I can go back and dig up my spreadsheets if I need to. But I remember doing sort of just a back of the envelope calculation a few years ago to try to see, like, okay, you know, what's the scale of like carbon sequestration? What's the size of that challenge versus what can biochar do? And I went to the UN Food and Agriculture database, and I got figures for the annual roundwood production. So all the wood that's harvested out of the forests in a year's time. And then another source, I got crop residues left in fields and stuff like that. So I said, okay, what is this crazy scenario where we take the whole roundwood harvest for a whole year and we take all the crop residues for a whole year and we divert them all to biochar production, and somehow in the process not incur any additional fossil fuel expenses in doing that, and convert all that carbon into char and put it in the soil, how does that compare to our emissions from burning fossil fuels? And it came out to something like 5% or something, some small number from this like sort of impossibly huge scenario. And so I thought, even if it was 10% of this impossibly huge scenario, we're talking about the possible carbon sequestration from biochar being this, you know, a few orders of magnitude away from the challenge of emissions, right? So I'm interested to get your take on that angle and what lies behind the carbon credit mechanism there. Like, do we really feel like this is a scalable way to address this, or, you know, like, to me it seems like it's kind of a big mismatch in scale there, and it's maybe incorrect to present it as, you know, like, this is like we do a big biochar program and it's going to take a big bite out of our fossil fuel emissions, and that seems like that doesn't pencil out. But how have you worked through that, and how have you sort of like squared that circle or whatever?
So Josh, I think one thing that is true is that decarbonization right now, it's probably going to be driven by solar panels and batteries, but there are going to be other technologies that help get us there too. Is going to do 90% of the work, right? Carbon removal is probably no more than 10% of getting us to net zero. So that's kind of the basic story, is that in a lot of ways, carbon removal doesn't make any sense if we're not achieving 90% of that target via decarbonization. But there will be 10% that we really, so actually when you look at your numbers compared to 10% now, biochar could achieve a significant amount of that 10% goal, right? I think the realistic goal would be that biochar is providing something like 10 to 20% of carbon dioxide removal by 2050. There are going to be other technologies that are more scalable, like DAC, direct air capture, is going to be a more scalable technology. But in a lot of ways, I think the scalability of biochar has to do with the fact that it's removing carbon from the atmosphere, but also providing a waste management benefit, right? It's not just that it's a carbon removal strategy. We still have to deal with all these organic waste streams, right? One way or the other, they have to be dealt with. So to me, it's sort of carbon dioxide removal with co-benefits.
So let me ask you about this. So you mentioned the electrification through solar and batteries and things like that. What's your view on... Because my view on that is, you know, about 20% of our energy is electricity, and about 80% is like liquid hydrocarbons for transport and stuff like that. And the feasibility of electrifying all that seems, you know, not kind of a non-starter. So are you like, what do you think about in terms of, I mean, I think of it as like an energy diet, like overall, we just have to use a lot less energy. We're not going to turn off the fossil fuels turn on solar and wind and kind of keep going at the same level. So there's going to be a big reduction in demand or just even energy consumption that we're going to be able to do. So how, like, and this is, I mean, and this is the kind of, this is why I get in so much trouble when I go to environmental engineering and science lectures and stuff, because in my field, there's a lot of like, here's a gizmo that we just bolt onto the existing system, you know, that controls pollution or does something. And I'm like, right, but you're assuming that the sort of high energy platform that we already live on is going to be sustained. And then with that assumption, we're going to add on these green technologies. And that's kind of what I'm concerned about. A lot of the doomer optimism people will be like, yeah, that's what we're concerned about, is that it's not feasible to just keep adding on these new things. So, what do you think about the feasibility of, and I totally agree with the idea that, like, yeah, getting, doing carbon drawdown and doing biochar programs, but against a backdrop of overall, I think, a big scaling back of our overall energy consumption?
I think, in my opinion, I think that could happen. I think it's a challenge to really, in practice, get very many people to reduce their energy consumption, their total energy consumption. I've never seen any data that suggests that we can get society writ large to reduce its energy consumption. But I will also say that I think that full electrification of many of our industries is entirely possible. I think it's going to take a while. I think it's very complicated, but I think there's a lot of extremely smart people going into the field. You know, I've heard recently that when you look at college campuses and engineering students today, they used to go into water, now they go into climate. Right, there's a huge number of very smart young people getting into this because they care. And frankly, because there's actually money to be made there too. There's a lot of dollars going into this too. And one anecdote that I always think about is with respect to things like solar. You know, one of the sort of pushbacks on solar is that it's going to use a huge amount of land, which is true. But if we were to electrify our entire economy, the total amount of land required for solar panels would be less than the total amount of land that's currently dedicated to growing corn for ethanol. Mm-hmm. We could take all of that land and turn it into solar panels, and it would provide way more energy than the current ethanol approach. So there are ways that we can get to where we're going, and I think it's entirely doable. And I view biochar really as kind of this piece that fits in, and all carbon dioxide removal as a piece that fits in to help us draw down the legacy emissions.
I've been kind of hogging the conversation there, but Tom, you and Kelpie, you want to respond to any of that?
Yeah, no, I think really what we're saying is that biochar can be a component. And I think that the benefits of biochar extend, you know, beyond the carbon side in terms of the other benefits. So, you know, the fact that we just don't notice the fact that we're reducing the carbon and organic matter in our soils and are reducing our potential for production and reducing the fossil inputs for producing food is something we ignore because it doesn't really bite us severely, if you will. But I think, you know, biochar is part of that kind of rebuilding the productivity of the soil. That is very subtle and slow, and people don't just jump at or recognize. But thankfully, I think the carbon markets and the carbon dioxide removal side of things is helping to provide some financing and some incentive. You know, I was hoping that we'd see more resurgence of biomass energy, and these are the people that are generating energy from biomass today are the ones that are managing the resources. You know, the forest, the crop residues, and so on. And that infrastructure we already have, and we should benefit from that infrastructure by and make products like biochar that can enable some of these other things. The fact that we don't put any value on electricity is a real drawback that really hampers our expansion or the integrated and multiple use of our resources. But I think we need to get there. So I think we need some structural things. I mean, we helped create the Natural Resource Conservation Service incentive program called the Soil Carbon Amendment, which was a cost share program for farmers to help them overcome that initial cost of biochar. I don't expect that to create a huge market, but I do hope that what it will do is get enough farmers using the material so it demonstrates the value of biochar. And then as we work down the cost of actually making and delivering biochar, then they will adopt it as a material. I mean, right now, what we've seen is large farmers, and we have farmers that are farming 3,000 to 5,000 acres of corn and soybeans that are using biochar strategically. But in most cases, their neighbors just think, well, that's a crazy guy that's using biochar. They're not adopting the technique, and the adoption of conservation tools like no-till and strip-till and so on is actually very low compared to our overall farmland. And so what we're hoping is that this cost share program will help just show that there are benefits and get other people to use it. I don't think in itself the program is not going to create a huge market. So at any rate, I think these things work together, and I think biochar can be a useful component, not just in carbon drawdown, but another in agriculture as well. Food production, waste management, the environmental applications like stormwater filtration and even water treatment. University of Idaho has demonstrated that as a carbon negative material used in water purification, biochar could potentially deliver or make water treatment carbon negative, which is pretty exciting. So, you know, everybody's working on different aspects of this thing, and I think it's more than just improving the soil or reducing carbon.
Right. Obviously, you know, considering it co-benefits, not just one thing. Tom, I just want to clarify if I understand something we were talking about before we started recording, and you mentioned again that one of the challenges is in the U.S. at least we have a fairly low price for electricity compared to Europe, and so are you saying that energy production being a potential big driver, and then the biochar that's left over, like as kind of a ancillary benefit from that, to where the energy, because like, obviously it's not just for biochar, but biochar and energy together, but maybe energy is the driver. And do you think then that we need to adopt higher electricity prices in order to encourage, you know, more of that kind of process? And I guess I'm thinking about that in terms of like something obviously is in the news big time these days is inflation is bad. You know, you go to the grocery store and the prices are up, and, you know, more and more working people are having trouble paying bills. You know, most Americans can't put their hands on $500 if they had an emergency, if a car's breaking down. And if then all of a sudden our electricity bills jump up by a factor of 2 or 3, like, are we in a position as a society to be able to withstand those kind of rising costs when of course, when energy cost goes up, the cost of everything goes up, right? Because everything uses energy. So do you, like, you know, how do we thread that needle, you know, because affordability is already becoming a problem for more and more people.
Well, no, and that's the affordability issue is a huge challenge. We also have a huge challenge of wildfires and that sort of thing. So if you take California as an example, California at its peak was generating about 1,000 megawatts of electricity from biomass energy, and they were consuming about 9 million tons of biomass. Today, that number is down about 4.5 million tons of biomass, and a lot of plants have gone out of business. There are plants that could increase their business. They could help remove the hazardous fuels, which is the biggest wildfire issue, and, you know, 4 million homes that are susceptible in the wildland, the interface, and a lot, you know, so what's the solution to that? If you made it affordable for the biomass plants to actually go out and get those fuels, then they could bring them in and make both biochar and electricity. So they would have to add to make substantial quantities of biochar, they would have to add pyrolysis equipment alongside their existing boilers, and so now recover 20% of the fuel as biochar as opposed to 2% of the fuel as biochar. Today, the largest biochar production actually is from processes that are primarily making heat or electricity, and you're only recovering 1 or 2% of the carbon as biochar. Whereas through pyrolysis and gasification, you can increase that biochar production, and at the same time increase the power consumption or power production, if you will. So, you know, what the level of the actual impact on grid prices, I don't know. But if instead of 10 or 12 cents a kilowatt hour, the biochar producers were getting, or even 6 or 8 cents a kilowatt hour, the biochar producers were getting 12 to 14 cents a kilowatt hour, and we pay you know, domestically, we pay what, 20, 25 cents a kilowatt hour. So, you know, if the producers, if the biomass producers could get more, that would bring people who already are used to the $100 million investments or the $150 million investments that are required for a good industrial scale production of biochar. So I don't really know what the impact on the consumer would be and how that impact would happen. I'm not familiar with how that economics works. All I know is that in Europe and in the U.S., we pay a lot more for electricity than it actually costs to produce it. So, but I think that's part of the solution. I think we make use of, if we had, for example, if we increased biomass power production, we would also increase cash flow to rural communities that we need for maintaining that forest resource. I mean, what we've done over the last several years is basically, especially in the Mountain West, is that we've shut down whole communities with restrictions on logging and so on. What about sustainable logging practices and cash flow that can go back into communities and maintain the populations of people and their skills that we need to manage our forest resource? And that's just the forest resource. If we look at field crops and field crop residues, you know, we send all of our crop residue from our grass seed production in Oregon to Japan and Korea and Taiwan as a feed supplement. It's a million tons. It's a process that evolved over a 40-year period. We started that work back in the 70s. That same material could be making biochar and energy, and it could be going into supplement the generation of renewable natural gas, for example, using anaerobic digestion. So there are various technical combinations that could be done if the value proposition was there. Mm-hmm. And I think the reality is that the value proposition with regard to electricity and even heat, you know, natural gas has basically put a ceiling on the potential use of power. And that's a huge damper on our ability to actually build facilities at any scale, small scale or large scale. Mm-hmm. So I think the energy equation is key. We're reluctant. In Europe, for example, they have much higher prices for electricity, and makes it possible to make smaller systems and to grow the technology and the applications of the biochar co-product in a more organized fashion.
I think we also need to recognize the energy situation we have today is probably not what we're going to have in the future, that this is not static. It's in flux, and we may be really approaching an inflection point here. You know, I ship my kilns all over the country, and the shipping prices have skyrocketed, you know, because the middle distillate fuels, we're experiencing a real shortage of those right now. That's our diesel. That's what really makes our economy work in terms of production, in terms of agriculture. Yeah. So, you know, you're not going to substitute electricity for diesel powered machinery. It's just not going to happen. Yeah, I'm really pretty much of a total doomer when it comes to the energy question. I lived off grid for 30 years with solar, and I had to run my generator a lot. It's an intermittent power source. Batteries don't last. They're expensive. They're heavy. They use a lot of materials. We're ripping up landscapes in Eastern Oregon right now to get at lithium. One of my favorite places here in Southern Oregon is a serpentine landscape that we had to fight off a nickel mine for years. And it's, you know, it's always ever present that they could, that could happen again. And so, yeah, I personally, think we'll be really lucky if we live as well as the Amish do today in 100 years from now. That's my perspective. So with that perspective, climate change is a worry, you know, carbon in the atmosphere, but I look at it also as a resource, you know, because 70% of our agricultural soils are severely degraded. And, you know, and we're just masking that now in the U.S. with more and more applications of chemical fertilizers, so we could keep pumping out the grain. But, you know, long term, how it's not sustainable, and we're poisoning the land with chemicals. And so we need the carbon. The carbon really heals the soil, and biochar really does a good job of that. And so I look at the carbon in the atmosphere as a resource that we're going to need to draw down to put carbon back in the soil. And we can do that through bioenergy. I think bioenergy is going to have a resurgence. And so we need to get ready for that and make sure biochar is part of the equation, because that's going to be really helpful for our long-term sustainability. So that's my doomer turd in the punch bowl.
I'm kind of in the same camp with you on a lot of that stuff. Part of my skepticism, or maybe even cynicism, about things like big carbon credit programs from governments and stuff and from big agencies is, you know, I obsess a lot about geopolitics, and it's getting harder and harder for me to take, you know, big top down approaches to fixing the climate seriously when, like, you know, our government blew up that natural gas pipeline connecting Russia to Germany. It's like, well, they obviously didn't care that much about climate change when they did that. They're telling me, you know, that we're going to have climate lockdowns now, you know, or ration driving or something like that. But and I think about, you know, to what extent are we just shuffling different impacts around? Like, for example, we destroyed Iraq and killed a million innocent people for oil. So now for electric cars, do we need to destroy Bolivia and kill a million people for lithium or something? You know, is it just going to be another, we're just shifting the burden around somewhere versus what are we really pursuing a kind of solution? So along those lines, so I don't want to give
you. Josh, can I put in the optimist view here?
Yeah, do it, please.
I am in no way a doomer.
Okay, good.
I'm a reform doomer. I used to be a doomer and I no longer am. And it's because I actually think that the quality of life for the majority of humans is better today than it has ever been in the history of the world. If you look at a whole bunch and almost any metric you actually want to get real data on, the quality of life of humans today is better than it's ever been. I agree, there are major environmental problems, but I actually view the likelihood that those problems get better. I think the only way that we improve our environment is actually more wealth to a lot of people, not less. Reduced wealth, I think, drives people to extract resources in ways that are unsustainable because they're needing to achieve their basic needs. You know, I'll just give one example. I think the world is improving, and I think it's getting worse at the same time, right? The environment is obviously suffering, but there are some solutions out there. It's going to be a very different world than it was 100 years ago, and 100 years from now will be very different than it is today. And I just need to push back a little bit on the lithium mining story, because the scale of oil production today is like 100 times more than the scale of lithium mining will ever be. So if we can use lithium mining to kill the oil industry, that would be a huge, huge, huge win for resource exploitation around the world. Enormous, enormous win.
So Miles, I'm curious to know what, so you're a reform doomer, what like tipped it over for you, or what changed to your outlook? Because I feel like what you just described and the points that you were just making, I feel like people in the doomer optimism sphere would start with those points and refute them and go in the doomer direction. So there's not a right way to go, but something happened and changed your outlook. And what was that?
I would say what it was trying to look really at, it was an argument that I had with a friend of mine who was talking about global famines. And he had this line where he said, oh, there's all sorts of people in Africa that are dying from famines. And you know what? There aren't a lot of people in Africa dying from famines today. There were a lot of people dying from famines in Africa in the 1980s, in the 1960s, in the 1940s, in the 1920s. There are not people dying from famines in the world anymore. It does not happen. The only famines that occur today are because of wars. Hmm. In the 1960s, in the Great Leap Forward in China, something like 20 million people died from famine. That does not happen anymore. The world is getting better for humans. I get it. We're damaging a lot of what we do. We are damaging the earth in a huge way, and it's a major problem. It's a major problem. But I don't think the solution is degrowth. I think the only actual solution to this problem is higher standards of living, so that we have the ability and the luxury to preserve these beautiful natural spaces around us.
Do you see that there is a way to expand these rising standards of living, but within the resource and energy limitations of the biosphere?
Well, I can say that when you look at metrics, so an interesting metric that I've looked at recently is GDP per unit energy used, per unit carbon. And around the world, that number is dropping like a stone. And in the United States, for instance, our carbon emissions have been flat for 20 years, but the economy has not, right? The economy continues to expand, but energy consumption, CO2 consumption, CO2 emissions have remained flat.
But to what extent is that because we've offshored a lot of production to other places?
It's not from the offshoring. In fact, a lot of those analyses include offshoring. There are some offshore emissions, but it's not from offshoring. It's because of efficiency. It's because of changing how we produce energy. It's because we're moving off of coal, right? Even the transition from coal to natural gas is a climate benefit. I don't love natural gas at all. I'm not a proponent of natural gas. But coal is absolutely horrible as an energy source. Natural gas is a little bit better. And then the real story, actually, in my opinion, is that price is going to drive this thing. And the price of solar and batteries are going to kill all the other energy technologies. They're already doing it. Solar is going to kill all the other thermal energy. I mean, I know that it would be nice to be able to use, you know, produce a lot of electricity, but I think solar is going to make it extremely hard for anybody to build a new thermal power plant in the United States, except maybe natural gas peaking plants that are paired with intermittent energy sources.
Okay, well, it's good to have some pushback on the doomer stuff too. This is interesting, and I feel like we could have, you know, three or four more other podcasts and delve into these topics because I'm still learning a lot about this stuff. But unless you guys want to jump in on this back and forth, I was thinking about, as we maybe start to wrap a little bit, a topic that all of us have various intersections with is thinking about the quirky properties of biochars and how they can be applied to perform in different kind of remediation situations. And maybe, Miles, you would be a good leadoff because you've done so much work with stormwater management and treatment with biochars. So you want to give like a thumbnail sketch summary of some of that work and how the interesting and quirky properties of biochar connect with production conditions and environmental applications?
Yeah, I mean, I could just give you a little rundown of some of the work that I've done. You know, in the stormwater world, a lot of what people are trying to do, they're trying to remove pollutants, but they're also trying to, I would say, modify the hydrological cycle, particularly in urban areas. You know, with all these paved surfaces, floods are bigger, partially because it's raining more under climate change. But the real reason floods are bigger is because we've paved the world. And a big part of what's going on now in cities is these facilities called green infrastructure or bioswales, you know, whatever you want to call it. And one of the cool things about biochar in those systems is that, yeah, biochar is removing pollutants. But the real story, in my opinion, is that it makes these plants really healthy. Those facilities are like plant torture facilities. Plants are exposed to massive floods. And they're usually planted in a bunch of sandy soil because you want the water to flow through it, right? You don't want the water to pool up in clay. So you put a bunch of sand. So it's like they get massively flooded every time it rains. And then suddenly they're like desiccated. So it's a pretty rare plant that wants to live there and they don't actually like it. And a biochar can really improve that habitat and sort of reduce the torture that these plants face. And actually, you know, a lot of ways, reduce the amount of money that cities and municipalities spend on maintaining these things. Cities spend a lot of money going around to these bioswales and replacing plants. Biochar can help fix that problem.
Cool. Kelpie, I want to specifically ask you, because I don't want to give away any secrets or anything, but I know you have a lot of cool case studies and examples, especially of like smallholders finding interesting and unique ways of using biochar. Do you want to highlight any of those examples that you've collected in your experience?
Well, yeah, mostly a lot of it comes from a conservation innovation grant that I worked on a few years ago with a group of small farmers in Oregon. And the purpose of the grant was to try to combine the two waste streams of forestry waste and manure. So there are like small goat dairies, a small grass-fed beef operation. And so in Oregon, especially, and probably where you are too, a lot of farms have woodlands. as part of the farm in a hilly area. And they have to manage those, especially here because of the fire danger. And so they're already managing all this wood waste. And so we developed some kiln technology and other techniques for making biochar, basically from burn piles, and then using it in the barns. And really amazing nutrient retention. We could, when we put it in the cattle barn at the beef operation, and the cattle were on it all winter, they just mixed the biochar in with all of their excretions, and it made this the most amazing compost fertilizer. So, you know, we, when we tested it compared to the regular practice of that farmer, which was just to scrape the barn and pile it, there was 10 times more nitrogen, more nitrate in the biochar pile. So in terms of being conservative and conserving resources, that was a great practice. And something like half of the forest land in the United States is owned by small woodland owners. So when we talk about scaling biochar production, Tom can attest to the difficulties of handling biomass, and it's widely distributed across the landscape. There's only certain places where it actually naturally accumulates at sawmills and, you know, food processing plants and so forth. So much of it is just going to be dealt with on the landscape. So this is how people are starting to use it, who have these small woodlands or need the fire protection, need the biochar for us, their chicken coop. And there's a lot of enthusiasm about it. It's a lot of interest in it.
Awesome.
Tell I think, me, yeah, so. let me build on that. Actually, the thing that's exciting to me is we've seen a lot of really good and productive science and applications in biochar in the last few years, especially in the last 5 years. And really it's taking the kinds of things Kelpie described and coming up with biochar-amended products that are not all that complicated from a production point of view, but allow you to strategically use the biochar and to reduce overall costs and reduce inputs and so on, and take advantage of natural sources of nitrogen and so on without burning up nitrogen. You know, people want to convert manure to biochar. Well, that's the wrong thing to do. You want to take biochars from the carbons and combine them with the manures, and then use the biochar as a vehicle to appropriately provide the nutrients to the plants. So there's a lot of that kind of science. There are things called organomineral complexes, which is combinations of biochar and clays that develop certain properties. So I think there are things that may yet take time for actual commercial deployment and application. But what we've seen is that the companies that are making fertilizers and soil amendments, particularly retail soil amendments, they've been kind of chewing on this bone for a while. They've been looking at biochar for longer than we give them credit for. What some of them are waiting for is a larger scale production of somebody who can provide a consistent quality of biochar or biochar amended product that they can then sell and distribute to farmers or homeowners and so on. So I think on the scientific side, in terms of developing suitable products for solving some of these problems, I see a lot of pluses, and I think we're beginning to, people are getting smarter about biochar. More people are learning about biochar. We get calls every day at USBI from farmers, from industrialists, and so on, and it goes through the whole gamut of what's biochar and how do I apply it, or who can I pay to apply it. All those things, but ultimately it gets down to fundamentals. What's the biochar doing for the particular application, and what combinations of things can you do, including biochar, to solve particular, especially agronomic problems, but even the environmental solutions as well. So I guess I've seen a lot of, I think, improvement and growth, and I'm optimistic about the use of biochar. I think a lot of our challenges in the United States anyway are really more building and operating a business to actually produce biochar and sell and distribute the biochar products, rather than the technology of actually making the biochar and providing it in bulk and so on. So everybody says, okay, where's the biochar going to go? How are we going to use it? We just have some big challenges on taking the pig to market.
So then, to sum up, would you all agree that the future of biochar is dark?
Obviously, yeah.
It's black.
It's black.
It's black.
It's
black. It's black.
black, but not bleak, right?
Black but not bleak. Oh, I like that. I like that. All right, cool. Well, like, let's okay. So, if you all go around and get just if people want to follow your work, they want to connect with you on social media, you want to highlight an upcoming event or a book or something like that, give a little spiel and we'll close out. Miles, you want to go first?
Well, I might tell you the same one that Tom might try to tell you too, but I'll tell you first. BioChar 2024, the North American BioChar Conference, will be in Sacramento February 12th to 15th, 2024. It's going to be the biggest yet BioChar conference in the United States. It's going to be great. And it's a huge time for BioChar right now. There's a lot of global interest, and we hope to sort of push the industry forward at that event.
Kelpie?
Yeah, I have a website, wilsonbiochar.com. You could, if you're interested in the Ring of Fire biochar kiln, the make biochar on your own property, you can fill out a pre-order form there and start communicating with me. I have kilns in stock. I just need to figure out how to get it to you, which involves a custom shipping quote. I do a lot of workshops every year. Mostly to follow what I'm doing, though, join the Biochar in the Woods forum, part of biochargroups.io, Tom's list that's been running for how many decades now? It's a great place, really. There's the regular list and then the Biochar in the Woods sublist. And that's where you can interact with people from all over the world who are doing biochar projects, ask questions, you'll usually get an answer. It's a wonderful, wonderful resource. So, you know, I kind of post what I'm doing on the Biochar in the Woods list there, but yeah, I'll be at the conference in Sacramento and hope to see you there.
Cool. Yeah, we've actually seen an expansion, I guess, to follow on with the U.S. Biochar Initiative. We've made a real push in the last year or so to push biochar and social media. We have the discussion list, but we also are on LinkedIn and you know, by land or by sea, any sort of means. We also have a newsletter. If you go to U.S. Biochar,
biochar-us.org,
then you'll find us and all of our links, but you'll also find us on Facebook and the usual social media. We also have put on a series of webinars. We're collaborating more with the International Biochar Initiative, and in some areas like Minnesota, we're seeing the development again of regional groups. So there's regional networking, and that's, I think, one of the benefits of our organization has been creating and supporting these networks in places like the Midwest. There's a Great Plains Biochar Initiative. There's an Eastern Biochar Initiative. And so we're putting people, as my father used to say, putting people together for hopefully moral purposes.
Awesome. Well, thank you all for your time so much. I definitely admire your work hugely, and it's been great talking to you. So thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks.